Smooth Tigers Radio 97.1 WLLZ. I'm Rogelio Castillo Alexander. Just joking. Welcome to Tigers Radio here at MotorCityBengals.com. And yes, I am Rogelio Castillo Alexander. It's Chris Brown. You can find us on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartMedia, Stitcher, and Google Play. And tonight, our guest, and this guy I've been wanting to talk to for a while because I'm a big fan of his writing. He also knows a lot about movies, which we were just talking about that beforehand. We'll revisit that in a little bit. Is Pat Ellington Jr., who is from Indians Baseball Insider. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's one of the spots I write for right now.
And talk about your little solo project, too. It's something that I've subscribed to on your email. And talk about that real quick before we talk about the show.
Okay, cool. So it's actually how I kind of got started in baseball. I started my own independent medium site in like 2019 with the idea that I'm just going to throw short stories out there. Just kind of give some background to preface. I've known I wanted to be a writer since I was about 12 years old. Started out with solely being fiction novels, and then when I was a teenager, it started to include screenplays after my love for movies kind of manifested itself in another way and started to grow. Baseball has been my favorite sport since the Indians went to World Series in 2016. And for me, just the series was just a way for me to delve in my interest in the game, because my interest in the game throughout my life has always kind of revolved around Black players. So throughout the diaspora, not just Black American players, but Afro-Latino players, Afro-Caribbean players. And now you have African-Caribbean players coming to that mix. So I have a series that Black baseball players, such as diaspora, in the major league and the minor leagues, that started in February 2020, which is about a year and a half ago. And it's led to me, writing and talking on various entities and talking to you guys about the game now.
Awesome.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, Justin Latta. It was something he shared on a link a little while back, and that's how I got into your writing. But Chris, why don't you ask the question we asked our first time guests?
Oh well, yeah. I mean, you kind of touched on it there, but I'm curious about your earliest baseball memory.
My earliest baseball memory would probably be hanging with my dad on Sunday and seeing just flashes of Derek Jeter in pinstripes as a kid. My I grew up an Indians fan in Youngstown, Ohio, but my father's from East Orange, New Jersey, and he grew up a Yankees fan in the '70s and the '80s. So, that was his favorite team. And, I was born in 1998. So growing up, Derek Jeter it was who I saw a lot. So obviously, that Derek Jeter is one of my earliest memories of baseball, cause he was the face of baseball throughout my childhood.
Yeah. And he's a much better shortstop and human being than Omar Vizquel, which we'll touch on a little later.
Okay.
I was just going to say, of course, I graduated high school in 1998, which is all
that's crazy.
Terribly humbling. I don't know. Did you see that? I just saw today the clip of, is it Kevin Hart talking to Don Cheadle? Have you seen that?
Yeah, damn.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. No, it's awesome. You know, I think it's fantastic because Raj and I always talk about, like, we don't always talk about, we touch about, like, hey, we need younger fans in the game. We need more diverse perspectives in the game, and we think it's important. So it's really cool to see you doing this and also to see you shining a light on some of the minority players in the game, because it's been an issue for baseball for a while now. I mean, I remember there were a couple of years there where there weren't more than one or two Black pitchers in the entire major leagues. And I don't know. I mean, I think
Black American pitchers, because it was,
yeah, I'm sorry. Yes.
And Dashrell Willis. But I mean, yeah. but it's another thing is how baseball identifies as Black players, especially the foreign born ones. Also, that's the big thing. And I know, Rogelio could probably get into that a lot and expand on that a lot and the intersection and how all those things work. And so definitely, and I feel like that's another reason why that my project kind of resonates with him also. And that's the intended goal is for me to be able to connect with people through other parts of the diaspora, in order to give them the visibility that they may feel like it's not there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just astounding sometimes, and we'll get to that another time about the you know, the cliches and all that stuff. But
right,
you know, but the right now, it's strange to think that, you know, the podcast actually was well timed as the Tigers today swept in Baltimore, did exactly what they're supposed to do. Meanwhile, Cleveland, I had to double check the score to see if that was accurate. 17-0 Is that?
Yeah,
is that,
they got cooked. They got cooked.
And, you know, yeah, Cleveland is one of those things that I was going to ask about this, Pat, in terms of right now, they've been piecing together a lot with the pitching staff. But right now, what is the big problems right now with Cleveland? Is it just, it's a matter of, there are some of the prospects not coming through. I saw Yu Chang was sent back down last week after struggling a little bit. And it just seems like they're not getting the consistency out of the outfield again, which is always, we've talked about this before with Jeff from Locked On Indians. We've talked about this with Justin. It just seems like what is just the offensive lack of firepower again. It just seems to be the case here.
So I will start with saying that Cleveland is the youngest team in all of baseball. They have the youngest pitching staff, and I think the second youngest pitcher playing group behind Toronto. Well, Toronto's pitcher player group is a lot better. Their pitcher player group is equally young, but they have a lot more years in the majors collectively when you just look at, and also the ceiling is just way higher for that group just collectively when you just look at, when you go individually to those names. And that's one factor is this, I wouldn't say it's a lack of talent, but I would say it's more so the talent has yet to supplant itself, and we have yet to see who's going to stick against the wall as they're getting drawn against it and who's not. Naturally, when you have young baseball teams at the major league level, they're gonna suck. I mean, in the first like 2-3 seasons of majors, your position players and your pitchers are gonna suck unless they're really good. And even so, what goes up must come down. And sooner or later, your rookies, the other shoe's gonna drop for them. So I mean, your rookies are gonna suck one way or another unless they're just a really good player, unless they just have a really good year. So I think it's kind of hard for young teams to succeed without failing first. So collectively, so I think that's kind of what this team is going through right now. Now, mind you, people are ready to cancel the Cleveland pitching factory tropes and all that just because of a lot of the starters struggling right now. But this is their first stint. Usually your young starters are garbage for their first 35, 40 career starts. So I think it's just people really being impatient with them kind of rebuilding on the fly. Like, it's really only been 100 games since they kind of started.
Yeah, I mean, it's in, you know, Chris and I are always amazed at how well they could put together. And Francona's out right now. He's going to be out for the rest of the year. But it's just its ability to stay in contention with just, and also a lot of injuries too. And the Tigers have been hit by the bug this week. We saw Grayson Grinder off the game early, and they thought it was a hamstring injury, but then ended up being just a cramp. But it seems like the injuries have seemed to hit every team, and Cleveland's got rocked pretty hard with it. In terms of starters, I saw like how many injuries or how many games they've missed because of injury. But Chris, I for the Tigers, I mean, the collision with Derek Hill and Akil Baddoo was hurtful, and they managed to pull it out today. They selected a contract to Jacob Robson, who Tiger prospect people are just like, yes, finally, bring up the Maple Hammer. And the Maple Hammer is coming into effect and just all that. And it's a feel-good story, even though, you know, he has a 35% strikeout rate in AAA, which is, you know, Pat, you know, was like, eh. But, you know, either way, you got to be happy. But honestly, Chris, it's just some of the injuries. The Tigers, I look, you know, tip of the cap, second place in a year with how much they've missed. It's impressive.
Yeah, you know, I think for the Tigers, it's been really impressive, frankly, for them to. I mean, they started the season as one of the worst teams in baseball, and now they're like a slightly above 500 team, basically, for the last 3 months, which is just something I wouldn't expect to see happening. And it's along with the injuries. Now, fortunately, I guess the injuries, I can't say that. I mean, you know, Matthew Boyd and Spencer Turnbull were kind of their two main starters this year, and they lost them both. But they still have Scooble and Mize. And it's like, you know, when you look at Cleveland, you're losing Shane Bieber, the Cy Young winner. And Zach Plesac got injured and hasn't been right. And who's their other big three? I'm forgetting right now. Savali. Yeah. So, like, that's super tough. I mean, that was the strength of the Cleveland org. And the Tigers, have, you know, they found some things this year, at least for the time being. You know, former Cleveland catcher Eric Haas has been a big story. And Akil Baddoo has been one of the coolest stories in baseball this year. And like you said, Derek Hill's been fun. They just seem to be finding stuff. So it's been really fun to watch. But yeah, I mean, I guess we knew this was going to be a problem across baseball this year with the injuries, just because of the shortened season last year and everybody worried. And I'm still kind of curious to see how it's going to play out over the final 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, it's going to, I mean, you look at the White Sox who are getting healthy, and that's just, it's all bad for the rest of the division, but it seemed like that was going to be the setup the way it was going to be. So, I mean, to me, it's just one of those things where the AL Central has gotten a bad rap, and kind of rightfully so. And the White Sox and Twins kind of going back and forth about whether, you know, the Twins have, you know, bottom out and everything. And that whole thing is just, it's funny hearing Twins fans kind of go, well, you know, just, they expect a lot more. But I mean, for Tiger fans right now, it's just, I can't believe we're in second place. Like, this is the first time we've done a show now for 4 years, and the Tigers have never been above third, I think. And they're
at least
four games under 500 right now.
Yeah. Like, they may have been above third, like two games into the season once, but yeah, definitely not this late in the year. Yeah. I mean, they kind of got hot in the weird last season heading into the final month and then fell apart. But, yeah, no, it's been fun to watch, and seeing them beat up on lesser teams is unusual and enjoyable.
Speaking of what's not fun, it is the QR categories. Like, Pat is very well aware of inside numbers and how that works. Is Omar Vizquel, and it was serendipitous that Pat, 2 days before that news broke out, you said that Omar Vizquel is the most overrated shortstop. You tweeted it out, and I was just like, because as a Tiger fan growing up in the late 90s, watching him in high school, feel like sometimes he hot dog the play or whatever, and just his arrogance just pissed me off. And then when he was a bench coach of Tigers, I'm like, all right, well, you know, what else am I going to do? And then you see the news that he was getting sued for sexual harassment. It's just one of the strangest stories I've ever seen involving that. It was like, just, oh man. But before we get to that, what prompted you to say that? Because I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, I've said it multiple times in the past. To people, I will say I never liked Omar Vizquel growing up. I just thought he was an overrated player. You know, in Cleveland, he gets a lot of praise from people, and I also think he's unrightly compared to Ozzie Smith. And Ozzie Smith has just had some shoulders above him as a player in every facet of the game. And I think Ozzie Smith is the gold standard for a glove for a shortstops, if we're going to be honest. Not Omar Vizquel. Omar Vizquel is maybe is a hall of very good for glove for shortstops, but no. Omar Vizquel being on the cusp of being on the Hall of Fame with the, I'm going to say, bad hitting numbers that he had with the good defense that he had and the endurance that he had while Kenny Lofton jumped up the ballot in his first season. I mean, his first year eligibility was just pathetic. And I also have a lot of beef with the baseball writers, Associated America, and how they conduct the ballots voting for the Hall of Fame. I found Curt Schilling getting that close and being on the ballot 9 times and them doing what they did after that fact, a spit in the face, and also him and also them waiting that long and really not even looking at his character, even when they put him out, was also a spit in the face. They handled so many things very, very wrong, and I just can't rock with that.
I'm glad you brought up Kenny Lofton, because he is one of the most egregious cases ever of a guy. Him and Lou Whitaker is a big one around here.
Lou Whitaker, absolutely. And to me, there's a correlation there with black and Latino players.
And I think
I don't like that shit.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
And, you know, and I think his religion has something to do with it, too, because he was a Jehovah's Witness. And really? Yeah, because, I mean, there was...
it's Whitaker, right? I don't know what Lofton did or didn't do.
Well, somebody pointed out that he never...
King Lofton didn't do anything but get traded a lot during trade deadline because he was
good. That's all it was. Yeah, he was just...
So, a plus center fielder with crazy speed.
And pretty good point guard, too, at Arizona.
Good power, yeah. And a 300 career hitter. So, yeah, no, he's one of...
37 on base percentage for his career. Like...
One of the best leadoff men of all time, really, and he doesn't get that credit. I don't know. It's weird. Yeah, there are times.
He played in the best era for center field. Well, one of the best era for center fielders ever, and he was one of the best of his era.
Yeah,
and he was clean.
Sorry. Yeah. No. That's
and he was clean. Like, come on.
Yeah. No. And that's
was what he I clean. Think. I mean.
I assume he was. I don't know anything about.
I can't remember if he was or not. You guys, that was your time.
He was. Yeah, he never was in that kind of realm.
I don't ever remember hearing anything about. I mean, there was, you know, Albert Bell was on that team, and there was always talk about Manny and stuff like
and
that.
Tommy,
yeah, but I mean, no, I think part of it was. I think you nailed it a little bit with that was one of the best eras ever for center fielders, and so you got kind of get overshadowed a little bit by like Griffey.
But I mean, even then, he still had good accolades. Like, he still had his fair share of numbers during that time period.
Yeah. So,
like, I mean, five straight seasons with over 50 stolen bases as a leadoff guy for one of the best offenses of all time.
Hey, look at this. He debuted on my 11th birthday. How about that?
No, he's that 1997 squad.
You're making me feel young. Stop it.
You were -7 at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
The 1997 squad is probably one of the best squads I've ever seen at Tiger Stadium. I mean, that was a team that walked in, and it's because Dennis Martinez is one of my favorite pitchers of all time, and he was still, I mean, I think it was towards the tail end of his career, and he was still lighting up a little bit. And I would imagine if Cleveland had another starter, they would have overcame the Marlins. But I mean, it's Jared Wright going Game 7 against Levon Hernandez is one of those games that, like, it just – I laughed at the Indians at the time because I did not like them because as a Tiger fan, this is a year before they joined the Tigers were in Central, but it just – it's like Cleveland – I wasn't used to Cleveland being a thing, and then every time they thumped the Tigers all the time. So, but, no, that 97 squad is sick. And also they had Travis Fryman, who was one of my favorite Tigers that the Tigers basically traded because they didn't want to pay him. So, at any rate, that's a flash. But yeah, Omar Vizquel got in some trouble. This is some, just kind of like, just you got to shake your head a little bit. And now you.
I mean, from what I've heard from people throughout the city, he was never a good guy in Cleveland.
Yeah,
we heard the same things when he was coaching here.
I've heard things in my time in the press box over at Lake County. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. There's one of those between the three of us. We've probably heard a lot. But anyway, the one thing that's going on, too, speaking of Lake County right now, Justin is getting some tweets as Lake County's taking on West Michigan. Gage Workman hit a 400-foot home run earlier. What the hell's going on in Erie, Chris? Holy crap. I mean, I'm sure you're like every 5 minutes, you're like.
Yeah, it was a wild day to throw up highlights. Yeah, they scored 15 runs in the first game of the doubleheader and then led off game three with back-to-back-to-back home runs. Spencer Torkelson went 7-for-7 today total with 3 home runs. And Riley Green, 2 home runs. Ryan Kreidler hit his 15th. It was, it was a good day to be a hitter for Erie.
That's insane stuff. And, I was just blown away. So every time my phone was going off, I had my phone off earlier because I was trying to get some non-baseball stuff done, and everyone I went to go look at it, I'm like, what is going on with the water in there? But nevertheless, anyway, let's just get into one of my favorite and honestly segments of all time.
It's time for Rogelio and Chris to go inside the numbers.
All right, so Pat, you are our guest this evening, so...
Mathematics, nice. I like that.
Yeah, oh, thank you. I put that together. Mostaf has been part of our production team for about 4 years now. Got to go with Mostaf. Like it makes sense.
I can't wait to get to the music segment now. I'm ready.
All right, Pat, so you're our first-time guest. What is your inside number for this week?
It actually was going to be the Indians being the youngest team in the majors.
That's good.
All right, that's cool. I mean, if you got something else you got to add to, I mean, if not, if you,
I mean, that's kind of the thing now. Is the youth movement happening? You know, with Cleveland and for me, it's unique because I've never, for me, being so young, I've never seen a rebuild on a fly like this before, and also just me being so intently engaged, closely engaged with the team. I've only been disengaged since Antonetti, sure enough, became the heads of the Cleveland front office in 2016. So, and that's kind of, so this whole thing up to now has really been interesting to see for me compared to how baseball rebuilds usually go, typically with the tanking and everything, selling and owners trying to make it cheap as possible. And while Cleveland's being cheap, they're doing it a different way where they're trying to, I just like the high wire acts like this. This is very interesting to see. I like the challenge. I like to see the problem solving skills in real time and the guesses and the gambles. Cause that's basically what this all is when it comes to player development. So it's just really kind of thrilling and cool in its own little way. If that all made sense, how I kind of made that come together.
No.
No, I get it. I kind of dig it's the Tigers have done it by exactly what you're talking about, tanking, getting these old veterans, trying to squeeze out some life out of them. And I kind of like the more just throw a whole bunch of young players together, like let them Hunger Games it out and figure out who could stick.
Which are good veterans.
You've got to trade. We've talked about it a bunch about it. It always bums me out that Cleveland just seems to trade. You know, whenever our guys are getting close to free agency, they just trade them. And how much of a bummer it is that Francisco Lindor, like, you can't pick a better franchise player, and they still got rid of him.
It's funny that we bring up Francisco now because Francisco deserves all the irrational praise that Omar Vizquel gets from Cleveland fans, and I'll say that on record. And we can put this snippet on Twitter because I want to smoke with that, Rogelio. So yeah. Let's get that. Francisco and Jose should have retired in Cleveland uniforms. They should both have statues, and because they were going to get a World Series eventually. I think they were. It was only a matter of time, in my opinion, for them, especially with this new wave of prospects coming now. If they kept Lindor there at short and you had Jose there at third, I mean, you can build around that for the next decade, no matter what. And for me, I totally forgot what I was going to say.
Next, no, that's good.
My fault.
That's good.
No, my bad.
You know, we can come back and revisit that in a second. So, Chris, what was your inside number?
So mine this week is 5, and it's kind of going to be like familiar territory to anybody who's listened before. But I still think it's kind of important. So 5, Matt Manning, who pitched for the Tigers today against the Orioles, he showed some signs, and he was especially with his fastball velocity late in the game, but he still managed just 4 swings and misses. And this is something that we've been talking about for years now. I mean, pointing out that when he faced good competition, he couldn't get swings and misses. And we talked about it when he first came up this year, and it's just keeps happening. That's now his 5th start this season where he's gotten 5 or fewer swings and misses. And I was kind of curious, like, how many other starters in the majors this year have done that, have had, you know, 5 or more games with that few swings and misses. And it's actually 19. So there's a fair amount of them. But the problem with Matt Manning is he only has 10 starts. So half of his 10 starts have had that low number of swings and misses. And there are only 4 other pitchers in the majors this year with a higher percentage of low swing and miss starts. And they are Thomas Eshelman. And his 8.02 ERA, he's 5 for 5 right now. Kohei Arihara from the Rangers, who has a 6.59 ERA. Brett Anderson, who somehow has a 3.54 ERA, I don't know how. And Jake Arrieta, who's got a 6.88 ERA and was just, I believe, cut by the Cubs. There's not really 2 ways about it. I think Matt Manning is going to need to find a way to miss more bats, or he's not going to be an acceptable big league starter.
It's funny, just from the outside looking, it seems like when the top pitching prospects for Tigers, like this current generation of guys came up, like it seemed like they really crashed and burned like badly. Mm-hmm. I heard it was like really, just from the outside looking, it was ugly. So can you guys like give me some context on what you guys feel about it, as you know, The organization, you know, seems like they're trying to play catch up with player development and stuff with the rest of the division and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I mean, last year Scooble and Mize came up, and you know, they're kind of the two bright young starters in the rotation right now, and they mostly got rocked. Scooble had a couple outings where he looked like you could see it in the future, and Mize had maybe one his debut
against the White Sox. Yeah,
And yeah, it was ugly, and it was like you were saying earlier, Pat, about like, you know, young starters, it takes them a while to figure things out. But they've made some very real and obvious strides this year, and a lot of that we kind of give credit to the new coaching staff and the new pitching coach, particularly.
It seems like they definitely made a turn this year. I should have said that also, because they've definitely. I did not know we were getting comments. That's cool.
Yeah, that's the first one. Yeah, Michael's correct by that. But go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
No. I mean. That's kind of really it. I mean, go ahead.
Go ahead, Chris. Sorry.
In a perfect world, Matt Manning would still be in Toledo this year. But the problem there is he was getting rocked in Toledo, too, for the exact same reasons. His ERA in Toledo. This is the weird thing. And this is one of those things that prospect people, not necessarily prospect people, but fans have a hard time believing, because he was the Eastern League Pitcher of the Year in 2019. He was untouchable in Double A. He had 160 strikeouts, 150 strikeouts, and 30 walks. Was an elite pitcher. But the issues that he's having now and that he was having in Triple A were always there. Whenever he faced quality hitters, like in spring training or at the Futures game,
he just kind of fall.
He couldn't put anybody away. His breaking ball didn't fool people, and his fastball didn't get past him. And
so does he have a viable changeup?
He has a changeup. It's not like a bat misser for him. He's developed a slider kind of on the fly this year, which is probably going to be his best secondary pitch if he can get more consistent with it. So they're working on it.
What would you grade his all of his pitches right now, personally?
Oh, man. the fastball is like I'd put like a 55 on it, maybe a 50, because it's the velocity. Like, he got up to 98 today. But again, it's like a super low spin fastball, but so not it a has, sinker.
So it has speed, but bad shape and no spin.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's interesting about him, he's a good athlete. You know, he was a basketball shooting guard, going to go to play for Loyola Marymount?
Okay, yeah. That's real good.
And he's
like, so
he's
really, like full scholarship.
Yeah, he's 6'6". He could play a little bit, and he's like super athletic in certain ways. Like, he throws a lot of strikes and he fields the position really well, but the command isn't.
Is he super still trying to figure out how to harness it?
I think you could say that. Yeah, I think he's. It's control over command right now, and okay. I think he's learning how to deal with failure for the first time, and he's doing it, you know, it like it's kind of like an avalanche.
At the worst time.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the Tiger's death is
at the worst best time. I mean,
yeah, he's learning that new pitch on the fly, but this changeup seems like it doesn't really kind of floats in there a little bit. But as far as to answer your question about development, Pat, the Terrence Scooble is the first pitcher the Tigers have had that has been developed outside of the first 10 rounds since 1991. Scott Eldred was the last Tiger pitcher, or I think 1990, actually. Scott Eldred was the last lefty that he was drafted, like, in the 12th or 13th round. He was a hometown kid. And since then, I mean, the Tigers have always had, like, you know, Justin Thomas was in the first round draft pick. So to have not, like, you know, Chris and I did a whole segment about the good and bad and ugly about Cleveland's 2016 draft and how they developed all those pitchers on that. Just giving them a plan and sticking with it. And you're seeing that now for the first time. I think, like, there's a big difference between pitching coach Rick Anderson and Chris Fetter. I don't know what no offense to Rick Anderson. I don't know what he did. Maybe he didn't do nothing at all. I don't know. But when you see the adjustments that Manning's making on the fly, based on the fact that we've heard it when we were in Toledo, we've heard Chris and I overheard the coaches, certain personnel people say, we told him to do this. He's not doing this, but he's working on this, like his pitching plan. There's a plan. I never heard that stuff before. I've been covering the minor leagues now for a good part of 5 years, I've never heard anything. And like you always earshot. Like I said, you know, sitting at the games, Pat, you hear certain things, you're like, okay, there's something going on. And that's what it is with this. And Chris Fetters gave him like a playbook, and just all this data is out there, and they're using it wisely. And it just like you, which leads to my inside number, which is for the Tigers, it is they, since July 1st, they have a FIP, their bullpen, as much as their bullpen scored the 23 scoreless innings, it is amazing that with all that going on in terms of what they've been able to do, Minnesota actually has a better FIP than the Tigers do, the bullpen. The Minnesota Twins have a 4.12 FIP, and the Tigers have a 4.9, and their WAR is about 6. So it's a lot of smoke and mirrors right now what the Tigers are doing. And I'm not going to complain about that, but that inside number to me just stands out because you look at, like, 23 scoreless innings. Wow, that's, you know, pretty impressive with some of the names in there. But you look at the numbers, and it's just what helps is having a K per nine at 9.39. That definitely goes a long way. But, yeah.
That's honestly probably below average for bullpens this year. It wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, but Tampa and New York are number one and two at 10.53, and the Yankees are at 10.18. Seattle is third with since July 1st with a K per nine 9.09, but they have a WAR of 1.8. The Seattle Mariners, which have one that have a really they still have a bad run differential too, I believe, as well. So
yeah, you
baseball doesn't make any sense.
No,
it doesn't. No. That's one of the more you watch it and the longer you follow, you go, I don't know, this doesn't make any sense, whatever. That's funny. Yeah, I mean, Seattle might be winning because their bullpen has been so locked down. You know, that's one thing that can really help you overcome a bad run differential is if your bullpen just shuts down the other team. So
yeah, they have a FIP of 3.50. So, but yeah, those are some interesting, it all ties together how the pitching staffs, even like I said, Cleveland's even hanging in there, their bullpen in FIP too, but I don't know. Baseball doesn't make any sense. It's anywho, so we move on, and it's now time for
the good.
Oh, that's good.
The bad.
Oh, that's bad.
And the ugly. I'm proud.
All right.
I wasn't expecting this much, Bob. I'm not gonna lie.
You were expecting Sergio. You don't expect things, some SpongeBob mixed in there with Sergio Leone, right? No?
Not at all. That was my surprise for today.
One of the greatest composers of all time. What do you get when you cross him and the SpongeBob craziness? All right.
Yeah.
The same guy who's the director. Wait. That's the director I'm thinking of. Sergio.
Yeah, Sergio Leone. I think Ennio Morricone or what? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. Ennio Morricone is the composer. Thank you. Sorry about that.
You know, those Italian movies.
All right, Chris, you're going to be up first on this. What is your good, the bad, the ugly this week?
So my good is Joey Votto. I don't think this is going to be a huge shock to anybody who's been following baseball the last month or so, but he's been absolutely going ham for a month. In the last 30 days, he's hitting 352, 440, 868 with 14 home runs. And I think people, you know, if they're paying attention, he hit home runs in 7 straight games and came like a foot away from making 8, which would have tied him for the all-time record, I think, with Griffey and I think maybe somebody else. And he had 9 home runs total in that time. And then he had 2 more last night. So it's fun to see for me because I do think he's generally considered one of the better guys in baseball, just like a good dude. And his last 3 years weren't very good. I kind of thought that he was basically over for him. Like they were getting progressively worse. And so I don't know. You don't know if this is just a blip or kind of a dead cat bounce or whatever you want to call it. But it's nice to see him having another really good season here at the age of 37 to me. Even though I, you know, don't particularly care about the Reds. My bad is I was going to go with Zach Plesac here, but I thought maybe Pat would or not. So I went with Zach Gallen. So I don't think there's any good stories coming out of Arizona this year, to tell you the truth. But this one is just kind of a bummer because Zach Gallen was kind of a sleeper Cy Young pick this year after having ERAs under 2.8 the last 2 seasons. And he was always outperforming his FIP. so that, you know, you didn't know for sure if it was going to happen again this year, but injuries have kind of done him in. He's had a hamstring and an elbow. He's only made 14 starts and he hasn't been terrible because ERA is 4.8, but it's been a rough month for him. He's 0-2 with a 5.93 ERA over the last five outings, and his walk and home run rates are at like career high levels. So I think he'll be fine. But it's just, it's a rough year, and, you know, it's just bad all over for Arizona. But they'll get the number one pick, I think. I haven't checked to see how close it is now with Baltimore.
They're both. I mean, Baltimore's terrible, but Arizona's playing better as of late. In quotations.
Let me see the standings. Just real quick while I'm doing this. All right, okay, so the Wi-Fi's not doing well. Whatever. All right. So my ugly... And we've kind of touched on this before with the nonstop sportsbook ads. I don't know if they're like that down in Ohio, but it's like every third ad here is something for gambling. And I just, all this gambling stuff is just a bit too much for me. Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm cool with people gambling on sports. I think if people really want to gamble, they're going to find a way to do it. You might as well legalize it and kind of regulate it and like any other vice, but it all feels a bit much to me for the majors. You know, there's that story about they're going to put a sports book at Wrigley Field. And then there was talk about putting one at Yankee Stadium. And, you know, like, again, I get it. There's tons and tons of money to be had in gambling. And so baseball wants in, but I just have trouble with it being so accessible now. I don't know. Maybe I'm just like a prude in that way, but like, you know, you can gamble on your phone now. You don't have to leave your house. You gamble, you go to the baseball game, you're gambling on everything. And I just think this is gonna be a problem for some people. Like, there are people who have legit problems with gambling, and there are people who probably conquered it or have it under control, and this is gonna push them back over the edge. And they're gonna be people who didn't have a problem with gambling and now will, because it's so easy, and it's gonna ruin some lives. Like, I don't know how many. And maybe that's not Major League Baseball's concern. You know, the same way they'll serve beer. You know, it might ruin some lives, but they don't really have to worry about it. But it's just like it just feels kind of gross to me. Like, this is just, they're all in with gambling now. Meanwhile, as we're speaking, they've got the Field of Dreams game going on, right? Which is based on the book Shoeless Joe, which is based on a player who's been banned for life for supposedly gambling on baseball. So it's just, it's all too much for me. And I don't know. Like I said, maybe I'm just lame, but I kind of find it gross.
Would it be the American Activity if capitalism doesn't entertain it?
There you go. That's a good point.
By the way, Word Vango commented on Twitter, on YouTube. I agree with you on that. He's, you know, and by the way, our good old friend Ray McConnell agrees with what you're saying, Chris, because you're right. And it is, because it's, you know, there's a lot of people. My wife used to work in the casino, and she's told me some stories, and I've seen some things firsthand too. And if you like it and you're controlled with it, you know, hey, that's cool. But I just, to me, and especially too, that we have at some point, I know for a fact, Chris, that we'll probably get a sponsor.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, ironically enough, and they're okay with us. No, but not, but you know what I mean? Like, that, it's just use responsibly, but I wish there's more disclaimers out there and kind of put it out there. But on YouTube TV, I have YouTube TV, every 5 minutes there's a FanDuel ad or MGM ad, every 5 minutes, and it's like clockwork, and it's just it's kind of annoying. We've talked about this before numerous times, but it's just get worse. But anyways, I digress. All right, Pat, what is your good, bad, and ugly this week?
My good thing, George Blair has 10 home runs in 25 games.
Oh, does he? Wow.
Yeah, he's been on the power tear lately, and it's kind of cool because I interviewed him in the post game right before this little home run tear, and he said, I've been trying to get behind the ball and lift the ball more because I don't like how many ground balls I'm hitting, and now he just does this, and it's really cool. And by the way, Blair is really cool to work with and stuff. He's good with the media. He's a good translator and stuff too, and his story is really cool. And shout out to him. He's a good guy. He doesn't really let the BS as a number one prospect get to his head. He's a good teammate. He has good leadership skills and stuff. And he's by example. And, you know, it's very cool to see. My bad was going to be the Omar Vizquel thing.
That's fine.
My bad and my ugly are kind of the same. They're both kind of equal, but in different ways. But I mean, honestly, The Vince Scott thing is the most ugliest thing, and there's so many layers to it. Just kind of compounds it even more, and we don't got to get into that but you guys can look for that yourselves. But I mean, it's just awful. And my other ugly thing, I guess I have one good thing, two ugly things would be, the other ugly thing would have to be, what was it? The minor league thing with the players getting crowded in little apartments and stuff, like six people in two bedroom apartments and sleeping kids and stuff, is ridiculous.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's anything. Hopefully, the Cleveland players can be treated well. There's an anonymous source from the Double A Erie for the Tigers, but again, we'll know what happened. But so my good is, since the All-Star break, Gamer Camilario has got a WRC plus of 167. He's batted slash line at 322, 413, and 567. And he's walking at a 13% clip, which is nice. And you look at his bat FIP, which is at 377. He's getting it done. Defensively, same thing. He's always been a sound, but the reason why the Tigers are where they are right now, in a way, outside of where Miguel Cabrera has been coming in handy, second half numbers are insane. But quietly goes about it. Candelario, I think, is one of the most underrated Tigers, and there's always this debate whether he's a solid pro or not. And I think this season's kind of verifying that he is a steady guy at third base, and that hopefully they get a contract extension. I mean, I think Candelario's been a rock steady force in the Tigers infield. And if you look at the chaos of the Tigers, have a defensive run save of minus 17 between shortstop and second, Candelario's right there and just doing a steady job. What were you gonna say, Chris?
Oh, nothing. I just sorry to interrupt your thing, but it was just the general silliness of the Tigers from the top of the organization to the bottom about playing guys not at their best defensive position. It's just really strange to me. There's something to be said for versatility, but you got Jonathan Scope playing first base all the time. You got a bunch of guys playing shortstop who shouldn't. You got Torkelson playing third base and Workman playing shortstop. It's just, I don't know. It's an interesting philosophy that doesn't seem to be bearing any fruit yet.
Yeah, especially because I look at the Indians, where Arias, who's doing really well. They got Jimenez just got called. Is it Jimenez that just got called out, Pat? Is that
Jimenez? Right?
Jimenez.
Andres, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he started the year. Did he start the year in Cleveland or no?
Yeah, he started the year at shortstop, and then they moved him. They put him, they sent him back down. But I think Cleveland's kind of on the opposite side of the spectrum, where they kind of value versatility, but they also value guys that can play up the middle positions. And they value defense very heavily, especially at shortstop, catcher, and center field. And rightfully so. But even in this era now, where we see he's able, you can have a player who isn't as good up the middle at shortstop or second base, who may have been at third or first 10, 15 years ago, just because of more fly balls and more strikeouts and less ground balls on the infield. That's that facet. But I think with Cleveland, they just like guys that can play valuable positions really well, because it's volume that you can. You're going to be able to find a great defender easier than you're going to find a great hitter. Just how frequently you can find certain commodities, I guess.
Yeah, Cleveland's been known. It's impressive how Cleveland puts an infield up every year. And just to see the amount of infield talent that's come out of there in the last 10, 15 years, it's impressive.
I say 3 decades. I mean, I kind of wrote an article about it. You got Vizquel, Baerga, Alomar Jr. during the 90s. Then you got Cabrera, Peralta, Martinez during the 2000s, then Lindor and Jose Kipnis, Bebo. And now you got another group of guys. But these guys are guys they traded for.
Well, it's funny because the Cleveland method of getting or building their farm system is almost like diametrically opposed to the Tigers, where the Tigers have nothing but corner bats. And Cleveland, like, you look at all their top prospects. I mean, Valera is probably a corner outfielder, but he can hit.
He is a corner outfielder.
Yeah. You got like Rocchio and Freeman, and was it the Angel Martinez kid this year? And the other is Bracho. Like all these up the middle talents.
Yeah, they got Gonzalez in the outfield too. I like Gonzalez, Oscar Gonzalez. And
took a couple, high school center fielders in the draft last year. I thought two or maybe just one, but yeah. And meanwhile, the Tigers just, is it Tolentino? Yeah.
Or what's 2020?
Yeah.
You're talking about 2020. They took, one center fielder, not Peter Armstrong. What's his name? Petey Halpin.
Petey Halpin. There you go.
Yeah. Then they took, three high school shortstops and two high school shortstops and three college pitchers.
Yeah.
Which is Cleveland.
Ton of pitching this year too.
Yeah, 18 pitchers this year.
But anyway.
So the bad I wanted to get into was it's unfortunately involving the Padres, and it's involving Dylson Lamette, who's going under procedure for a hip infection. And so originally he had he was having forearm inflammation, but he had to get a procedure that was taken out to where he had is a hip infection. So, you know, this guy, Lamette's been kind of like this name that's been talked about, and for in prospect circles, he's done really well, but it's another step backwards for this guy. I feel bad for him, honestly, because the San Diego system is ridiculous, and Pat can test this firsthand. And you know, it's funny too. I didn't even think about the historical context of this all too. It's the Padres in Cleveland done this before with Joe Carter, correct? I mean, this was
they got them out of Marbury.
Yeah. So it's kind of weird how these two teams have this historical context of trading with each other in big trades too. It's not like something small. It's always some big significant trade.
Yeah, they trade a lot of top talent between each other. Even recently in the last maybe like 3 or 4 years, they've done a lot of big trades.
Was the catcher too,
Francisco Mejia?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's when he was at his peak value. That's when he was like a top 20 prospect. Catching prospect. And you got to think about too, he was a switch hitting catcher prospect with a rocket cannon arm. Like he was in the Victor Martinez comps and stuff. And that's just what Cleveland does. They like switch hitting up the middle guys.
I just remember the one from when we were kids. You mentioned Joe Carter, but I remember that was all involving like Sandy and Roberto Alomar and Fred McGriff, and like that was a huge deal when we were tiny.
That was like it was eight guys or something like that. But my ugly, by the way, is one Pete Haley of NBC Sports, who, by the way, first and foremost, and I don't know about you, Pat, but I can't stand jackasses who obviously troll for clicks. And this is what this jackass did. He's a jackass. I don't care if he hears me or not. I mean, he might be an NBC football guy, and I'm just a schmuck from Michigan, whatever. This guy's a jackass. Last night he tweeted during the game, quote, "Watching O's and Tigers and realizing how little I thought about Detroit freaking Tigers in my life. What a boring franchise. Have they mattered since the Ty Cobb? First and foremost, you know what the hell you're doing when you're saying that, you jackass. There is seriously, like, why? I don't know why this is such a thing on Twitter. Like, let me tweet something so stupid so people can click and I can respond on it and spend half my time on the phone trying to respond to Tiger fans, knowing full well how Detroit Tiger fans are. You're a jackass. Okay, seriously, you're a moron. And honestly, like, just this whole, he was born in 1994, but here we are. I'm talking to Pat, who was born in 1998, and Pat knows probably more about baseball in his finger than this guy does in his entire body. It's just like, it's ridiculous. And just the trolling aspect of it all. Just shut up. Just enjoy the game. Like, you don't have to tweet something that stupid to get clicks. And he got what he wanted. He knew Tiger fans were going to react. I mean, hell, he knew the Tigers at Tigers.com was talking about the ratio. And by the way, fantastic job there by Greg, who's a social media guy for the Tigers. It's ugly. I mean, this was the tweet. Have you mattered since this ratio? Yeah. And damn, it's just like, if you're curious what ratio means, as Chris explained in his article, it's when someone makes a bad tweet and garners so much higher number of comments than retweets or likes.
So, honestly, I'm just happy that they started letting me see quote tweets now. I said I had to like fish for them. That's so beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, I agree.
Like whether it be some funny things or complimenting people, getting compliments or somebody getting torn apart for doing stupid stuff.
Yeah. And more of that needs to happen. And it's ugly for this guy because he's just a jackass. And I was like looking at that yesterday. I'm like, come on, dude, you know what you're doing.
It's crazy because like even if you're a casual baseball fan, you would have definitely seen Justin Verlander during the 2000s when they got Miggy. Yeah. I mean, come on. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, This is stupid. Like, I vividly remember watching Miggy on ESPN every night during, as a kid, 2012, 2013, 2014, when he was in his prime. Like, it was crazy. Like, it's my childhood in baseball. I mean, I'm sure you kind of understand that. You guys growing up in the 90s and 2000s. That's a good comment, Ray. That's a really good comment.
Ray's pointing out some shared pain.
Yeah, but definitely. But it's funny. Cleveland's been a lot more competent over the last 3 decades than Detroit has. And it's weird. Detroit has so much more money, but it's kind of funny how far shoe farm office can get you and how far money can get you when spent properly. Yep. But one thing goes wrong. I mean, but baseball is just such a chaotic and unpredictable sport, and there's just so much parity involved. You're gonna lose most of the time regardless.
Yeah, especially because Cleveland has been, their front office personnel, they've turned out to go elsewhere, is amazing. It's just the impressive alumni that goes across that.
Most places it's better. It's very, I think it's a bit overstated compared to some other front office trees, but I think it's definitely one of the best internal front office trees in the history of sports, just concerning with who the last heads have been and how they've done for a small market team like that when it comes to them building competitive teams the last 3 decades, literally. They've had a team reach ALCS for the last 3 decades.
Yeah, that's something that's very understated.
And we talk about it, they've done it by getting rid of a lot of really good pitching, like award-winning pitchers they've had to get rid of because they couldn't afford, and they've still been able to rebuild.
They've won, and these pitchers won 5 of the last 20 Cy Young Awards, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, Bieber, Kluber, Lee, Sabathia. Yeah. That all, is that 5 of them?
Yeah, that's 5.
Yeah, it's
and super. Think about all the ones that are placed in the top 5. I mean, you had Cookie and Clevenger getting top 10 that one year, 2017, and Bauer was there that next year, and then Kluber 2016 he placed, 2015 he placed. So yeah.
I wonder if
they're really spoiled. And one thing for me personally, CC was my favorite player growing up, so it was really, it was really cool seeing a black pitcher growing up for me, and I really can't overstate how that enough. And it's weird. That's kind of it was a theme for me with my fandom for baseball even before I started writing about baseball. When I was 7 or 8 years old, I got suspended from school in second grade, and my mom made me write a book report about Satchel Paige, and that was really kind of. Really, when I really started getting into baseball, I come from a baseball family on my mom's side. My family likes it there. My great grandmother played in Negro Leagues for a few years. So,
oh wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. Did you ever see? I know you're. We can get into some film stuff now because we always like talking about film. I think you're done, right, Raj? Were you done with your?
Yeah, I'm almost. Yeah.
My fault. My bad.
No, that's good, man. Because I wanted to. I definitely want to talk about this.
Before we do the transition, though, Chris, we do have to talk about Manscaped. I'll take care of the lead this week. So
I just wanted to say I wanted to mention so we could before I forget. There was a movie I don't remember the name of it, but it was an HBO movie and it was about Satchel Paige, Jackie Robinson, and Josh Gibson. And
it was Delroy.
Delroy Lindo, Blair Underwood, and
the guy who played Josh Gibson was in Forrest Gump.
Yeah, he was. He was Bubba in Forrest Gump.
Yeah, I know. I've heard of that movie before. I think so. Yeah. Anyway. I haven't seen it. One of my friends told me about it, but I haven't seen it.
Again, that came out 4 years before you were born. I'm legitimately impressed that you know mathematics, considering that came out in '99.
As a film nerd, I'm taken aback by. All right. I'm hurt right now, man. You follow me on Twitter all this time, and
I knew about that, man.
I know you know it, right, Leo. I'm just taking it back right now.
No, but
thank you, Chris. I appreciate you.
It's before we move on to talk about
movies. I'm joking, by the way. You're good.
Before we move on to talk about movies, let's talk about the Lawnmower 4.0 from Manscaped. And this is an opportunity to clean up your – it's the Performance Package 4.0. It's the join the 2 million worldwide who trust Manscaped and get your rocket ready for takeoff by going to manscaped.com for 20% off and free ship with the code FANSIDE20. Yes, folks, if you are trying to get your area trimmed up for a date this weekend, Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer has – this whole package is great. It's got a weed whacker for your nose, so that way you don't look dumb. The crop preserver, which is for your ball deodorant, crop retriever toner, performance boxer briefs, and a travel bag for your whole system. So again, go to manscaped.com/fansided20 to get your 20% off and a free shipping with the code manside. So go to fansided20. So go to manscaped.com and put the promo code and tell them that Tigers Radio sent you over. So enjoy that copy. And yeah, so 20% off and shipping. Yep.
Yeah. And as I said last week, if you, if somebody buys it and shows it to us, I will tell my story. So maybe nobody wants to hear that.
Yeah. Y'all are struggling for some monetization right here, huh?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I've been doing this now.
That was hilarious.
That was brutal. I'll tell you that much. But I'll be honest about it. No, it's just like we even didn't want to put a Patreon out, honestly. But I mean, at the same time, we've been doing this for a while, and going to games, stuff like that, those cost money. Every once in a while, would be cool to have.
I mean, I'm just like, I'm so curious if you really put your manhood on the line to test this product out. So, look to you, man. You're different. Yeah, I would never.
I'll do whatever. I don't care. I got stories. I mean, I'm not going to put videos out there or anything like that, but I've got a whole bunch of theories. So we're going to have to keep doing this, but I'm going to save those for later.
That 1948 book, Ray, that's a good recommendation. We'll have to put that on. Do we have any questions, by the way, before we move the movies, Chris, or no?
The only one I saw was, like, what's our scouting report on Adelin Rodriguez?
He doesn't swing at spin. He can't swing at spin. Next question.
Well, he can swing at it. He can't hit it very well.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
And I mean, that's the thing. Like, he's a 29-year-old. He's got close to 200 or more than 200 minor league home runs. He's never been called up to the majors. Generally, there's a reason for that. We know that sometimes guys just need a chance to prove it. But, yeah, he's a classic kind of quad A slugger, if you will. And I think he should go to Japan and make a bunch of money hitting 40 home runs.
Yeah. A lot of the tweets we get about him are in Japanese. It's actually pretty cool. So, get in the movies, Chris. Where do you want to go with the movies direction? Because there's a couple of ways we can go about this. I mean, we're talking about baseball movies earlier with Field of Dreams, and Pat and I were talking beforehand about it's kind of slightly overrated. Oh, apparently somebody wants to tell this story now. Oh boy.
I can't, like, somebody's got to buy the trimmer before I'll do it. It's just the way it goes.
Yeah, go to manscaped.com for it, and then put the promo code FANSIDE20.
Yeah. There you go. So, I told it on a podcast. I told it on Marquise's show like 5 years ago, randomly. So if somebody wants to go back and find what it was, used to be Fanarchy or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I guess just kind of the similar thing we were talking about with earliest baseball memories for Patty. You said you were writing, you wanted to be a writer at a really young age. So did I. I never really tried to write a screenplay until I was like 15, but you said you were starting when you were like 12.
Oh no! I knew I wanted to be a novelist at 12. I didn't start writing screenplays until I was like 16 years old.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of curious what inspired you to get into the film aspect of it.
So I've always loved movies my whole life. Just as much as I love books and things like that, movies and TV. When I was a kid, I actually had a VCR collection and a DVD collection. My father is a big movie guy, so he had a DVD collection with the towers and stuff. And growing up, he watched some movies with me, Spike Lee movies and stuff. My mom would watch some movies with me growing up, and I remember going to Hollywood Video with her and buying VCR tapes and stuff like that. I say my earliest movie memory would just be. If that was a question,
Yeah,
that's a question. Probably just taking the VCR tape I had, like the very first season of SpongeBob. Now I wore that thing out.
That's funny. Yeah, we didn't get a VCR as a family till like 1993. My brother got one because he was tired of our family not doing anything with stuff. My parents were just kind of cheap. We didn't get cable or anything like that. But no, I was just like, it's interesting, Pat, because the first like radio show I ever did, it was me and my friend Perry, who was a film critic. He went to film school, all that stuff. And so we'd spend like an hour and a half talking about baseball. And then the last 30 minutes would be him basically schooling me on film. And it's kind of fun. So I don't know. I mean, you mentioned Spike Lee stuff. I don't know if there was any particular like adult movie that really caught you at a young age.
First adult movie that caught me.
And I mean adult as in like adult themes, you know, not like.
Definitely. Remember early me. I remember, so my parents, they really made me watch a lot of black films they grew up on, or they saw when they were teenagers during the 80s and stuff like that, or they saw during the 90s when they were in the 20s. So Cronenberg Early Me was really that movie. It's about, I don't know if any of you have seen it, it's about the basketball player with the afro who gets shot by the police. It's Lawrence Fishburne as a kid. It's a quintessential black movie, in my opinion, just for black American cinema, but also fits into the larger piece of African cinema with police relations and stuff. For me, that was a big movie for me, personally, when it comes to adult themes of, you know, just in this country of race, and me as a black man and understanding how things are, what happens and whatever. So
talk about in terms of like VCR collection, VHS collection, we got our first VHS player I was like 10 or 11 years old, and we got it from Montgomery Ward's, and actually it was still working until like 4 or 5 years ago. It was still, I think it was a beast. And I was the only one that could figure out how to do the VCR plus code to record on television, because we didn't have cable till my freshman year of high school. And you're talking about adult movies and kind of those things that stand out at a young age. And in terms of VHS, we would rent, just because I watched a lot of like local TV had like the Saturday afternoon horror pictures, you know, like the Channel 20 horror theme hours and those cheesy vampire movies, the Christopher Lee movies. Those are things that I remember. A lot of those bad, I grew up watching a lot of Star Trek reruns and what have you. But in terms of VHS collection, it just didn't really, like movies, like people talk about like Stanley Kubrick movie and stuff like that. I never really got into it until I got older, because it was just something that like I enjoyed. If you're going to tell me, that's true. I like the way he's reserved about that. We didn't say Forrest Hump or, you know, like something like that. But, behind the green door or whatever. That
I will, movie is, which I will say one
scene or not.
One of the first movies I've ever remember seeing is legitimately Debbie Does Dallas. I was not supposed to. My brother's 6 years older than me, right?
Yeah.
And he was watching the neighbor's house and took me over next door and started playing it. I was like seven. I was like, what's going on?
No, but as far as movies are concerned, just one of those, it to me, it was kind of like, we grew up watching a lot of like just bad B movies, a lot of horror movies, a lot of vampire movies, like I was mentioned earlier. And my dad had an affinity. It was funny because my dad, he loved action movies. I mean, he was like, he would always say, que paquete, you know, he would just say like, what a load. And he loved it. He loved that. He was a big, big action movie guy. And every Saturday night we were the neighbors around the block from us, and we watched like bomb movies or culture movies. Like my dad was really trying to get us into, when he lived in Spain for a little while after he left Cuba, like, oh, you know, this is what Spain looks like. And this is, you know, because we went to Spain a few times, but you don't remember that. And just, but they watch a lot of telenovelas, Sábado Gigante, and the big game show on Saturday nights and all that. But my dad, in terms of movies, he was always, always in the cheesy action movies, and just the sci-fi stuff came from my older brother. And I eventually getting into style, like I got into Quentin Tarantino movies and that kind of stuff from my older brother. And even with like, there's a couple of good movies that have been done in Latin America that Y Tú También. That's a movie I haven't seen.
Y Tu Mama También.
Yeah, Tu Mama También. Yeah, that's a good movie. But there's just, But for VHS, though, just getting back to VHS, all I mean, it's just a bunch of series of B movies, like Children of the Corn, like Stephen King stuff. Like just a lot of stuff. It's just like,
oh, man. a lot of straight to video Stephen King movies, man. I remember those the bad ones from the random books he would just throw out there. Oh man, that's kind of funny because Stephen King is one of my favorite writers growing up. So
me too, yeah. Creepshow was based off of Skeleton Crew, correct?
I haven't seen that one actually.
Oh really? Oh no, Creepshow is fantastic. And if you read Skeleton Crew, the story, I don't know if you read Skeleton Crew.
I haven't read. That's actually one of the Stephen King books I haven't read.
Well, there's a story about a lake, and it's in Creepshow. Have you seen Creepshow? Mm-hmm. Chris, have you seen Creepshow?
I don't think so. What is
Creepshow is a movie. It's a series of short stories in a movie, and it's based off some of the
stories. So it's anthology in a movie. So it's anthology.
It's like kind of like Scary Stories, that book, but just.
I remember Cat's Eye. Was he involved in that thing at all?
Cat's Eye?
Never mind that.
Anyways, but just get a chance to read that. And that's what kind of like those things were involved into eventual, like I said, a lot of indie movies. Hard Boiled. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie at all.
Yeah, I love Asian cinema. I'm a big Johnny To and John Woo fan. Asian cinema is a huge. Especially Hong Kong and Korean cinema, and I actually studied film when I lived in China, when I studied abroad in China. I love Asian cinema. For me, world cinema is a huge, for me growing up in the internet age, world cinema is a huge facet in how I understand movies, foreign movies, especially in the subtitle era, where subtitles is probably more welcome for people my age because we watch a lot of anime and a lot of foreign stuff, and I know Rahelio can attest to that. That's kind of make that full circle. I love Asian cinema so much. Prodigy, he talked about it on Mac 10 Handle.
Noriega mentioned it too. Said something like Hard Boil You like John Woo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. I like Johnny To a lot. I like Johnny To a lot better than John Woo, though.
Johnny To is one of those. I'll have to check that out. But this is what's amazing. It's just part of the Creighton collection. Mm-hmm. But my older brother would randomly, this would do, he would randomly check out a VHS movie and something like this, Hard Boiled. And we still talk about this movie to this day because it's such a well, I mean, there's so many times. I think there's like not a like a second where there's not a gun being involved and or some sort of like explosion and Chow Yun Fat, by the way, Chow Yun Fat is in his prime here, and his comedic timing too. Like he's just when the baby's pissing on him and put out the fire and all that stuff. Like yeah, anyway. But so
I have a hot take.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think The Killer is better than Hard Boiled.
Oh no, The Killer is better. No, you know what? I can't, and anybody who's not familiar, probably some people right now who are like, okay, what are you guys talking about? The Killer is a, let me see if I come up here real quick. This is for people watching on YouTube. Right here. This is fantastic. This is right here at his finest.
Yes. And kind of reminds me, for those who don't know, this movie is based on The Samurai by, what's his name? I cannot remember that guy's name. Look at the Samurai.
Kurosawa. Which, by the way, this cover right here remind me of Gogo.
No, Le Samurai, the French movie.
Oh, the French movie. Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
The French one.
I think we did that then. But this cover right here reminds me of Gogo 13, which is an anime. So yeah. Again, we're geeking people out right now. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like it, I don't care. That's fine. This is
oh, the shades definitely and yeah. Explosion, but definitely it is giving me a lot of Gogo 13 vibes for sure.
Yes, especially that gun like right there. It's like a classic. We see that in that movie all the time, mm-hmm. that anime. But yeah, no, The Killer is a good one. That's a good call. And I can never find. I've not been able to find it on Blu-ray. It's been a while since I've even looked, but. That's a good call, Pat. No, I don't.
I pirate a lot of movies, so I have it Blu-ray digitally. I have 2 terabyte. I have multiple terabyte hard drives filled with movies and TV shows and stuff.
And I was just telling Chris that I've been watching Miami Vice. Mm-hmm. I've been just going through the first season, and Michael Mann.
Michael Mann is my favorite film director ever. Yeah. So I'm a Michael Mann disciple. I'm pretty sure you see me talk about Heat every week.
Yeah, and that's what I kid you not. That's what got me going. I'm like, you know what? I should look at Miami Vice because it's one of those things where I never watched. I watched it as a kid, but you know, when you watch things from a kid, you don't really get involved. And then all the stuff Michael Mann's done since, you're like, okay,
well, you see a click, you just see a click. Yeah, that's always been for sure when I watch things that I've never seen as a child, or maybe even when I learned certain things in movies or as a writer, as I kind of learned from experience or reading or something like that, and I go back and watch it again, even afterwards, I see things differently, or just. Seeing movies are like puzzles, or like Rubik's cubes, especially directors and writers who weave things into the movie, the Easter eggs and everything like that too, and just even more because they know those certain people like us, the nerds, are gonna watch the movie 20 times. So I love that, and that's kind of what I want to do with my writing as well, to interact with my audience and to reward them. Because I think you reward your audience things like that, and you also reward yourself by being good enough to do things like that as a writer.
And it's even, you can do that on a podcast form too, with like some of the regular segments and kind of the inside jokes that people start.
Oh, the illusions and just building up that continuity and just that tangible stuff and material. Yeah.
But Miami Vice was done in 1984. And you look at it now, there's elements now that you see now in movies that are like standard, but go ahead.
Michael Mann, the precision and the attention to detail is timeless, and like it really helps movies age well, even when, because it gives the ageness of the time period a charm by being well done and being clean and well cut and things like that. And to me, one thing I really love about Michael Mann well is he uses a city, and he makes a city a part of the film by using, and just the way he uses the variety of environments, whether it be offices, downtown, suburbs, yards, houses, everything like that, and just the diversity in the locations just to show the city's true character and everything like that is very good. And also how he's willing to simulate things and also do and also pay business for the time to use their atmosphere and their locations. I like that also. That's the big thing for me is set design and using locations. I give a feel of atmosphere that correlates to what you're trying to do. Like you feel it, you know, so it sucks you into the atmosphere with the movie even more, you know, because he just uses the whole medium so well and combined, and he's such a good writer also. But he also puts so much into it to make sure he gets everything he can out of it, take advantage of, be able to use the visuals to go along with the writing to make them emphasize each other. And what Heat for me is how he kind of uses the postmodern stuff of LA to contrast and also comment on like neo-noir and the gangsterism and everything like that, kind of how old fashioned Al Pacino and Robert De Niro's characters are in contrast to the environment there, which is kind of what it was modern then, because it was quintessential near norm movie and still is even now, even though it was the 90s. So,
no, it's interesting. And Michael
Mann. Sorry for the tangents, by the way, guys. It's my fault.
No, it's awesome.
You're good. No,
because we've talked before. Because I also he's kind of like a camera nerd too. He like makes his own cameras and stuff. And this is kind of funny. I mentioned that I always liked to write, but I didn't know what I wanted to do with it. And then I saw The Insider, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I decided, you know what? I'll just go into journalism then, because I'm going to be Al Pacino. And then I went into journalism. They're like, yeah, you can make $25,000 a year. I'm like, all right, see you later. but still, it's still one of my favorite movies. I love Michael Mann too. So that's really cool to hear.
Yeah,
I'm a big Al Pacino fan, by the way.
Yeah, so here's a funny. You actually settled this debate here, Pat. So, Scarface, which was done, which was directed by
Brian De Palma.
Brian De Palma.
Yeah. Written by Oliver Stone.
Yeah, written by Oliver Stone. When I worked in retail a long time ago at Best Buy. Everybody, when that movie first came out on DVD, that was the most requested movie of all time. And I watched when I was a kid. I was like, okay, you know, and then as I got older and I started understanding the Cuban culture a little bit, I'm like, no. It's just because my dad has such a visceral hate for it. And he's just like, you know, Gasolized. That's a crappy Cuban accent, and capturing that whole Cuban scene incorrectly a little bit. Chris loves that movie. I don't like that movie. I don't like that. I don't care for it. Brian De Palma has done better movies. I don't know if you watched the movie with Brian De Palma movie I'm thinking of that's really good is the one with John Travolta, where he's a sound. It's John, of course, John Lithgow plays a serial killer type person, shocker, because he's really good at that. I forgot the name of the movie, but John Travolta plays a guy who collects sound for movies, and he actually picks up a sound of a senator getting shot and killed. And he gets all of a sudden out of nowhere, he's targeted to get killed and part of this whole government conspiracy thing. But Brian De Palma directs it, and it's, I think, in 80, 81. And trying to draw a blank and remember the name of the movie. Anyways, that's a better Brian De Palma movie. That's one of his best movies.
It's Scarface. Blowout.
Blowout. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Blowout. Really good. I don't know if you've seen it, Pat, but that's a very good
movie. I'll look it up, though.
Yeah, you got to look that up. But
I like Carlito's Way.
You like Carlito's? Okay, Carlito's Way is better. I don't like Scarface.
I hate Scarface. I hate it for the reasons you mentioned with how it portrays Cubans and things like that. But that's kind of that whole era with the 80s and the crack era and everything. And then we can get into that's a whole another story thing in itself. Because that just bleeds in totally different other things that we just can't get into. Yeah, I just don't like that movie. I really feel like for everybody involved, it's objectively bad movie, but the charm is there because it's objectively bad and what the era represents and how it kind of is a microcosm of the crack epidemic and the war on drugs in itself and things like that. And kind of correlates with how Hollywood kind of aligns with the government and how coincidentally things correlate. So,
I feel like I should clarify that I don't actually love Scarface. It was just a huge movie for me growing up. Because
I understand that it was a huge movie. It was everything for you guys growing up because it fit the era so well.
Basically, when I saw it as an adult, I'm like, oh, no, this is not really very good. But it was like so many rappers, like the Ghetto Boys, their whole self-titled album was like, it's like 40% Scarface samples. And they used the Mobb Deep has used the beats from Giorgio Moroder for the soundtrack for like three or four different songs. Immortal Technique did it for a song. Like
hip hop is really entrenched on movie samples a lot. Or hinge on movie samples a lot, and it doesn't get enough shine, especially horror movies and Scarface and stuff. But horror movies, especially, is really overlooked.
I discovered within the last year, there's a rapper I like named A$AP Rock, not A$AP Rocky, but A$AP Rock.
I know who A$AP Rock is.
He had a song on his album Labor Days, last song on the album, and I've always dug it, and it's called Shovel. And I was watching Carrie earlier this year, and I'll be damned if it's not the song from the prom in Carrie. She's walking, and it's a sample from that. I'm like I never would have thought in a million years it was from that.
Yeah, like you said, horror movies. On I know 36 Mafia, they sampled the noise of Jason 13th, the breathing noise. They did that multiple times. So
yeah, that's well done, but the. Either way, it's I find it funny that like just that Brian De Palma does that movie and then there you saw about the did he do Untouchables too, right?
He did Untouchables too.
Yeah, and Untouchables is actually not bad of a movie, although you know when you read the true story about Elliot Ness, it's far different from the movie. The guy was a drunk, he was a womanizer and all that stuff. But again,
don't let truth get in the way of a good story, man.
Yeah, the Irish guy who never
heard the legend.
Yeah. The Irish guy who never existed, and but
when I think of Brian De Palma, I just think of I'm not a super film buff, but it seems like every movie he does, there's like a super long pan shot. It just takes like a minute and a half. And then comes back. Like there's a couple of them in Scarface where he the infamous hotel room scene where he'll start there and then he goes all the way out to the car and it takes like a minute and then he comes all the way back in and they've got the chainsaw going. It's just kind of an interesting filmmaking technique to me. I don't see a lot of other people use that.
Yeah, it's changed a lot, but it depends. like, you know, Marshall Stacey, like, I'm thinking of The Departed when Matt Damon's character first walks into the police station and they do the first blow and they don't, they show him going up the steps and he kind of jumped down straight to going to the office. Mm-hmm. I kind of hate that in the movies, like the old movies where they show the guy walking to the office, you know, cut to him opening the door, you know, cut to him walking through some hallway, you know, cut to him going up an elevator and asking the weatherman about the weather and all this thing and who won the pennant.
No, and that's the difference between what you're talking about Miami, the way Miami, he uses Miami, Michael Mann does, really speaking, to Brian De Palma, who talks, it's just more like a kind of like the hustle and bustle of, you know, the south side of Miami. And then you see Michael Mann kind of talk like the architecture. You're looking into some of the shots in Miami Vice, you know.
He really digs into the, whatever location he's in and really absorbs and captures what it is. And that's a really real skill. And for me, what he, I'm just thinking about, you know, like that was a real shanty town he filmed in and the chop shop and all that. Like, or like that was a real homeless guy he included in the movie when they were doing the bank or when they're doing the bank Dharma car scene at that intersection. Like, and then to me, is that's the most important part is the authenticity, because it adds a layer that's noticeable, but it can't be captured unless you really put in the work. Like he had, like even in Thief, you know, I have a book. I was spending $100 on about the bank robber who was a consultant on Thief, and how when he was on the consultant for that movie, he was on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list.
Wow. That's wild. Well, that's like you talk about Insider. He actually had the real attorney general from Alabama, I think it was, or whoever.
Whatever. Yeah, like I mean, the real attorney general was in it. Yeah, and he had actual police officers train the police officers, and he had criminals train the criminals.
No. Yeah, the Edward James Olmos did it when he was talking about when he first became part of the scene or he joined the cast after the original lieutenant died, or the guy who was in Barney Miller, I forgot the guy's actor's name. But anyway, he told Michael Mann let him take the, it was, the office was kind of busy with full of stuff. And instead he goes, I just want a bottle of aspirin and a clean desk. And that's it. And Edward James Olmos' character, Lieutenant Castillo, which is a sweet name because obviously, but no, it's just because Marty Castillo is just a serious, straight-laced. It's the same character he plays in Blade Runner, but not as curmudgeon or not as angry. Because if you look at his character in Blade Runner, it's the same kind of like, I'm pissed. You don't. There's a lot of lines get cut in Blade Runner. They don't see that. You see him going, okay, I wanted to be. He was trying to be more ambitious and get ahead a little bit, but you don't see that happening, unfortunately. But in the way Michael Mann uses Edward James Olmos in that show is phenomenal, and just kind of like minimizes just minimal character. He's always got the same black shirt or black suit, the white shirt, black tie. Always has this look on his face. No, fuck it. You guys go out and go check some things out. Like he's just his eye intense entire time. He's like, yeah. So let's go out here and we'll go from there. You're okay? Yeah, I'm fine. Even keel every time, and just anyways, I can go on and on about that and Miami Vice thing. But
one thing I really like about Michael Mann is how you can tell he learns from his past movies and kind of builds on certain things and certain themes. You can tell he just plays with certain concepts over and over again, or works them and things like that. Like with Thief and Heat, there's so many elements he carried over and kind of improved on with the movies and the concepts and everything like that. And it was really cool to see. Because you don't see many directors get a chance to do that.
Also, the way he uses the soundtracks, it's chef's kiss right there. I mean, that's...
Yeah, especially electronic music for back then. That was very, very groundbreaking. And using bands, like... what's that band he used for Thief? I think Tangerine, electronic bands. I'm sorry, I'm a music nerd, too, so...
Yeah, don't get me started. We could go all over on music on that. Yeah. That's another hour. We'll have to do that for another supplemental podcast.
I mean, you want to talk about music, but I mean, we could talk about it. I mean, we can talk about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're almost at the hour and a half point, but I mean, I think next time you have you on, Pat, I can literally talk 30 minutes about the movie Cool World and how it totally changed the way animation and that crossed together in one of the best soundtracks of all time. You want to talk about 20 minutes about Future Sound of London? Yeah, go Bakshi? Ahead. What'd you say, Chris?
Is that Ralph Bakshi or whatever his name is?
I think so. I'm trying to think of Gabriel Byrne was in that movie. I'm sorry. I was just thinking of the actors in that movie. It was early Brad Pitt, too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyway, I can go on about soundtracks too. Good movie soundtracks and all that. But Pat, thanks so much for joining us, man. This was really good. Yeah. And we'll have you on again for sure. What do you want to pimp out? Any links or anything that you want to have people check out your work again? And thanks for everybody who's listened to us on YouTube and on Twitter. And again, some of the great comments this evening. And Pat, where can people find you on Twitter? And we're just, we'll put your link on, or your Twitter link on our description, but where people can find you?
Cool. You can find me on Twitter at tangible_UNO, TANGIBLE_UNO. Anything you want to pimp out? I have a series where I cover Black Pistol players, writers, scouts, front office members, managers, coaches, etc. In modern baseball, Major League Baseball, called the Clubhouse Conversation Series. These are players, individuals from all over the diaspora. I've done 8 series. I've done 6 players, 1 writer, and 1 front office member so far. That's kind of like my crown jewel and the current advancement of my Black Pistol player articles. You can find my Medium page, tangibleuno.medium.com. That's kind of where I run my coverage of Black Pistol players that I do individually, and my own culture website where I am the senior baseball contributor. I work for Indies Baseball Insider, where I cover the high affiliate of the Cleveland Indians. And I also am a weekly contributor for the Locked On Indians podcast with Jeff Ellis. So
Jeff Ellis, good friend of the show. If you ever if you get a chance, I don't know if you guys talk about board games, but Jeff and there's one podcast we talked for an hour after the show about board games. We were talking about Settlers of Catan. So if you want to get in Jeff's,
I'm not a board games guy.
Yeah, no, but yeah, for real, it's amazing. Jeff and I were just sitting there talking about Chris. Didn't he talk to you about Settlers of Catan strategy with you for a little while or something like that?
I don't remember if it was or not. I mean, we definitely. It's funny. I just got a call from Perry today for the first time in like a year, and Perry's my big board game friend. And yeah, we were talking about board games for a little bit, but yeah, I don't.
This is what it's like to be 50. I don't want it.
No, hey, wait a minute. I'm only 40.
I'm sorry. Tell me,
you play Monopoly, didn't you? Did you ever play Monopoly? Life?
Not at 40.
No, but yeah, no. Jeff's a good dude. We've dealt with him for years now.
Great, man. He's really great. I got to give a shout out to Shaquille Taylor and Jim Ramos. They really kind of both helped me start my career and helped me get to this point.
Nice.
And so I definitely got to give them a shout out. And Shaquille, she's good people. She's from Youngstown, like me. So.
Yeah, we had her on the podcast in February. We did an album before the baseball started. We actually did an album review on Low End Theory. And I was talking about, like, we were going to have her on talking baseball. I'm like, well, we're going to do a little bit of music because it was off season and you need to fill out some time. And she's like, well, what album? I'm like, well, Low End Theory, because it celebrated. And she's like, and she sent me a picture of her in a Tribe Called Quest t-shirt the day at the time that she was wearing that. She had a Tribe Called Quest tattoo. And I was like, oh, that worked out pretty well. It was one of my favorite podcasts we've done this year, because we talked very little about baseball. We talked about a little bit about baseball and her, some of the things she's uncovered too as well, which is her knowledge and just respect of the game is fantastic. But even the summer of 54, I bought a t-shirt just to support it, even though I'm nowhere near a beer in Chicago, but I want to support a cause like that, which is near and dear to her. And at the, and just also for the game in general. So, but yeah, that Tribe Called Quest podcast, maybe a lot of our regular listeners didn't listen to that year. That was a lot of fun, to do. So, yeah. I mean, we actually got to play something. We got to play this.
Coast stomping, ripping and romping, New York, North Carolina and Compton.
Yeah. And then, this was our favorite one right here.
What the fuck is that? I'm going to make Low End Theory.
Documentary.
Yeah.
It was not by any grand design. I was just in a very huge learning.
Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, she's great people. So
absolutely, man. She's dope.
So I will put that link for Pat's Medium on our description for tomorrow. So if you guys want to check out his work, please follow him on Twitter.
Put the clippings for my Twitter bio. I think that'll work better.
Okay, no problem. But yeah, there'll be a link in there. So cool. Please follow Pat's work. He does a fantastic job. The level of detail and attention to detail writing is something, like I said, maybe for the Michael Mann podcast or the music podcast, they'll be coming out separately on a bonus episode. But Pat, thanks so much for joining us again. And we'll hopefully catch you at a game in Lake County soon.
Oh, definitely. I would like to meet you guys, hang out, maybe have a beer or something. But thank you guys for having me. I really enjoy being here. Appreciate it.
All right, no problem.
Thank you guys for letting me have access to your audience.